This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Yesterday, the U.S. House of Representatives overwhelmingly approved a measure that would stop the bulk collection of American phone records by the National Security Agency. Instead, phone companies that already collect that information would be the ones who do the collection, and the NSA or other agencies could petition the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court for access in specific investigations. That legislation was co-signed by Vermont's lone Congressman Peter Welch. It's one of a few bills he's introduced that relate to how intelligence is collected and to what the American public is allowed to know. Today on the program, Representative Welch joins us to talk about this and other issues he's been working on. Congressman, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be back.
So let's talk a little bit first about that bill that passed the House yesterday, the USA Freedom Act. You were supportive of this bill. Why do you think it's a better deal to have the phone records collect this and then to have the NSA or other agencies petition the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court for access?
Well, it protects your privacy. I mean, the phone companies have that information right now. The government can't get to it unless it has a warrant under traditional constitutional application of our civil liberties. What has happened with the bulk data collection provision by the NSA, which essentially was a totally illegal overreach on their part, is that they started directly gobbling up all of our telephone calls, who we called, when we called them, how long the call was. So the government was the one that was actually vacuuming up all of that information of every American, and that's just an astonishing overreach. And in fact, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals said it was flat out illegal. You know, and a second thing, aside from the privacy invasion and the complete disregard of our constitutional rights, it's a pretty stupid way to do intelligence gathering. You know, you've got to focus on where you should put your resources. And when what you're doing is creating one haystack after another, so you can search each one for a needle, when it may not even be relevant to our national security, that's just a dumb way to do it. So this takes the government out of the business of getting access directly to our information, and I think it's a vast improvement. Senator Leahy, as you know, was a leader in the Senate. The bill that we passed in the House with my support was exactly what Senator Leahy had designed in the Senate.
You know, when you talk about the fact that this should further the privacy interests of Americans, is there any sense that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court would be strict in granting access? Because, you know, the phone records are already there by the phone company. And if the NSA and other agencies can request the records, if it's basically, yeah, whatever you want, we'll give it to you, that doesn't seem like much more protection.
Well, I share that concern. And in fact, in the law, there's going to be a FISA advocate, not someone who's specifically a public advocate, but who's going to have access to making the argument on behalf of the constitutional privacy rights of Americans. So you're going to have, and you're going to have publication of FISA decisions. So the secrecy that has enshrouded the FISA court itself and creates the problems that you just outlined, that's cracked to some significant degree in this legislation as well.
The vote yesterday was pretty unequivocal. It was 338 to 88. This morning, a bipartisan group of senators and representatives who authored the bill called on the Senate to get moving on this issue. Senator Leahy was among them, as you mentioned. He is also a supporter of this plan to remove the government from the bulk collection of data. But it's pretty unclear how the bill is going to fare in the Senate. What's your sense?
I think it's going to pass. I mean, there's presidential politics at play to some extent. Senator McConnell, of course, is against this. He wants to continue the privacy. He wants to continue the Patriot Act as is, even though the Second Circuit said it's illegal. And some of the presidential candidates over there, including former ones like Senator McCain, basically want to give a free hand to the government to get whatever it is they feel that they need. And that's just an imbalance, obviously, in between protecting America from terrorist activities and protecting constitutional liberties that we've had since the founding of this country. But I think at the end of the day, this will get passed because the current law is illegal. It's been declared illegal. So it really makes it pretty tough for Senator McConnell or Senator McCain to argue that we ought to continue what now has been declared illegal.
Because now that it's been declared illegal, basically the provisions of the Patriot Act will be sort of allowed to expire.
That's correct.
Right. Do you then go over to the Senate at this point? I mean, do you, what's your role in trying to further this action in the Senate? You know, given that you're in the House, how does it work for you to try to go and you know, ask people to support this? Do you do that?
I'll tell you, Patrick knows what he's doing over there. He doesn't need a lot of help from me to come over and give him some advice on how to get it through the Senate. We're very lucky. I mean, he is the ranking member on Judiciary Committee. He's the author of the bill. What's great about our relationship, he and Bernie and me, is that we talk and strategize. And if there's anything I can do, sometimes there have been moments where I've had an ongoing relationship with a House member, like the chair of our Agriculture Committee, or Patrick might be able to help me, tell me who to talk to that might move something along. But it would be anything I would do would be specifically based on advice given to me by Bernie or Patrick.
And so far, you haven't gotten that on this bill.
No, you know, Patrick's in charge over there. Mm-hmm. He's going to get this done. So I'm really confident as a Vermonter that we've got the best advocate on this in the Senate that we can have.
Today, we're talking with Representative Peter Welch. We're going to be talking about the work he's been doing trying to get the government to reveal how much it's spending on intelligence and surveillance. Relatedly, he's also working on legislation that would retool how bulk collection of phone records is done. That's what we've been discussing right now. And listeners, if you have a question about those issues or other things in Washington that you want to see Representative Welch get done, or you think he may be working on and have a question on him for him about them, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Representative Welch, while we're talking about security agencies, you've reintroduced legislation that would require the 16 intelligence agencies in the federal government to reveal how much they spend on their intelligence activities. Why do you think it's necessary to know that top-line spending number?
The beginning of oversight for Congress is to focus on the budget. And if you give essentially a blank check to the intelligence community, there is much at risk of running amok as any other agency. So I think it's really basic taxpayer responsibility and accountability that we would get a top-line budget number from the CIA, from the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the 14 other intelligence agencies as to how much taxpayer money they're spending and the year-over-year increase. This does not in any way interfere with their activities, because obviously this doesn't disclose what the nature of the activities are or who's doing what or any kind of secrets. But it's basic accountability. And in fact, it's interesting. There's a number of very conservative Republicans, including my co-sponsor, Cynthia Lemus of Wyoming, who see it the same way, just basic accountability. Lee Hamilton, who was the head of the 9/11 Commission and a very respected long-term member of Congress, is a strong supporter of our legislation on this. So he's somebody with very high national security credentials who understands that you've got to have some oversight, active congressional oversight, to make sure that our security agencies are doing their jobs. And oversight begins with budget accountability.
But if they still don't have to reveal what they're spending the money on, what good does it do to know that number?
Well, it's a start. I mean, that's a good point. I'd actually like to get much more information. And see, the irony here is that I can go into a secret room and get secret information. But then when I get that information and start looking at it, I can't disclose that to the people I represent. So we're a long way from getting access to the financial information that I think we need in order to exercise the, I think, very aggressive oversight that's required for the protection of the taxpayer and the integrity of any program, whether it's intelligence or food stamps, for that matter. But we have none when it comes to the intelligence community. We've got 16 different agencies. I'd like us to be able to get more access to their information so we can begin asking questions about how much overlap there is, how much duplication, how much waste. And I would be the first to acknowledge that the top line number is minimal information, but right now we have no information, and I'm trying to create a culture of accountability when it comes to the intelligence community.
Well, so where's the balance then in your mind, Peter Welch, in finding out and being able to reveal what the spending is for and why, you know, if you're going in to advocate for, say, lowering the budget of the NSA and you can't reveal to taxpayers why, then, you know, where's the balance in terms of keeping security and keeping things that need to be private, private, and being able to reveal what you think you need to do that oversight?
Well, the area where we absolutely can't reveal anything is similar to police investigations, sources and methods in specific programs. And, in fact, we in Congress don't necessarily need to know that. I don't need to know who, say, spy sources are. I don't need to know certain methods by which things are carried out. That's with, obviously, some exceptions. But in terms of gross spending, like what's the personnel, what's the payroll, how much are we doing on cyber, things where you can start making comparisons and ask questions, even if it's in a committee that has some private closed hearings, that's information that's going to enable Congress to be much more effective in trying to do the job of oversight. You know, when you don't have oversight, things get out of control. I mean, think about what happened with the torture program. Members of Congress did not know that was going on. Had that been public, that we're torturing people, there would have been an uproar, both in Congress and, I think, among the American people. You know, there's a long history here of the CIA funneling arms to the Contras in the 80s, and they now have access to drones. I want to make sure that those aren't used in any way that compromises American rights. So there has to be oversight here, especially when an intelligence agency, is empowered with such authority and such latitude. The work they do is very important, but that doesn't mean that it should go without scrutiny and without accountability.
Let's go to Terry, who's calling in from East Montpelier. Hi, Terry, you're on.
Hi. The New York Times recently called this the kind of intelligence reform that you were advocating for, intelligence surveillance reform, the post-Snowden era. And I'm wondering, I mean, it seems clear that the country owes Snowden a debt, and that you and your ability to make decisions and make policy owe Snowden a debt for revealing what was going on in the government. And I'm wondering how you will repay that debt and what your plans are to try and bring some justice to Snowden and some recognition that he served America rather than being a traitor.
Terry is, of course, talking here about Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks. What do you think, Representative Walter?
Well, two things. First of all, how do I try to repay it? I mean, I think we've got to reform the NSA. The bill that we passed the other day about bolt collection is a direct response to the revelation that the NSA was doing this overreach. So public policy has to be changed in order to protect constitutional liberties. And I think that was, I think, giving Mr. Snowden the benefit of the doubt, a concern that he had. So Congress has acted, and I will continue to act, including with my effort to get greater accountability on our intelligence budgets. On the question of what should happen to Mr. Snowden, I think a lot of these factors should be taken into consideration, but the legal process has to work its way, and he's got to make a decision about whether he's going to come back, and the authorities are going to have to make a decision about what to do under those circumstances. But I know a lot of people feel the way the caller does.
And let's go to David calling in from Greensboro. Hi, David. Your thoughts.
I wanted to ask, why don't we have a public advocate provision in the Leahy-Sensenbrenner USA Freedom Act that would allow whistleblowers, a public advocate outside of the executive branch, that would allow whistleblowers to go and bring this very important information that people like Thomas Tam and Edward Snowden have brought out, and not have to become criminals, to become victimized by trying to serve the public interest?
Well,
shouldn't there be a public advocate they can go to?
I favor a public advocate. That was a matter of debate and contention as to how far we could go with respect to getting the public advocate that you describe, but I support it. What we did get, we didn't quite get it. We weren't able to get that just in the legislative process. What we did get was a panel of experts that advises the FISA court on privacy and civil liberties, communications technology, and technical and legal matters. And it also codifies very important procedures for the recipients of the national security letters to challenge non-disclosure requests. So we didn't quite get to where you're suggesting, and I'd like us to get there, but we did get people in the room whose specific position is to keep an eye on our constitutional liberties.
And while we're talking here about these issues, Claire is with us from Swanton. Hi, Claire. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Peter, for being on. My question is, Snowden, first of all, Snowden is my hero of the year, maybe the decade. But once the government has everything set up, which we now know they have and have had for some time about data collection, what or who or how will there be any guarantee that they actually stop?
You mean as a result of this law?
Yes.
The law prohibits the NSA from doing this bulk data collection. They just can't do it. They can make specific requests, but it has to be based on articulable suspicion. So,
I guess to Claire's point, and speaking about Edward Snowden, this was a secret program until it was revealed by WikiLeaks. So, you know, whether or not it was specifically prohibited, it certainly was not known to the American public.
That's true. Yeah, and I don't know that there's any way that you can absolutely guarantee that there won't be some people in any operation, including the government, that may violate the law. But that's what it would take. You know, this has been exposed. The NSA bulk data collection has been declared illegal by the courts. The Congress in the House of Representatives has passed a law making it illegal. And hopefully the Senate will follow and the president will sign it. But if there's some rogue element in the NSA, then they're clearly violating the law and would be subject to the full prosecution of the law.
We're talking today with Representative Peter Welch. If you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Ken is with us from Ticonderoga, New York. Ken, go right ahead.
Congressman Welch, thanks for being on.
Thank you.
The question I've got is, now that the 14 Democrats in the Senate have cut some kind of deal with McConnell on the TPP, how are you, the Progressive Caucus, and the Tea Party in the House going to put the brakes on fast track in the TPP and give Vermont's GMO labeling law a chance to exist after the fact? Because TPP and the ISDS provisions will cut the legs out from under the anti-GMO labeling law. You won't be going to burn and win a battle there. So how is the House?
Well, I think you're right. And just for the listeners, let's tell them what those initials stand
yes.
for. You know, the TPA is Trade Promotion Authority. That's the so-called fast track. I oppose that because what it means is that there'll be an agreement negotiated largely in secret where when it's presented to us in Congress, we will only have a choice of yes or no, up or down. We won't have any opportunity to amend it, say to put in a provision that says you can't take away the right of a state to decide what it wants to do about GMO labeling. Your concern is a very valid one. So I'm opposing fast-track trade promotion authority. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is the specific new deal, new trade deal that would be under consideration. You know, NAFTA was one in the past, and there have been many. I continue to be very skeptical about these trade deals. Here's the question for me. Is it going to result in better pay and wages and more employment for Vermonters? That's the bottom line question. We've had a number of trade deals over the past several years, and here's what has happened with those trade deals. Corporate profits have gone up a bit, and the gross domestic product has gone up a bit. And by the way, those are good things. I'm for that. But what hasn't gone up is wages. And we have got a major, major problem in Vermont and in this country, and it's stagnant wages. Families are working hard, and no matter how hard they work and get a second job, they're not able to pay their bills at the end of the month. And they're trying to figure out how in the world are they going to save for retirement? How are they going to be able to afford to fix a bad car or replace it? How are they going to send their kids to college without these kids getting out with a mountain of debt? And, you know, bottom line, I want to know how is a trade agreement going to help those folks with those challenges?
We are talking today with Congressman Peter Welch. And again, if you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Coming up, we're going to talk about energy efficiency. We'll get his take on the Bernie candidacy, and he'll answer more of your questions. Again, our number, 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with Congressman Peter Welch. We've been talking about intelligence and data collection. We're going to look at some of the other issues he's been working on in Washington. And if you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Enrique in Middlesex who says, "We continue to see new buildings, public and private, being built with extremely poor energy efficiency. What is the purpose of having a state-sponsored corporation like Efficiency Vermont with 30 years in the business if they cannot dictate proven high energy standards? And what is it going to take to implement a real energy efficiency policy?" Congressman Welch, you've been working on energy efficiency issues for quite a while, so this is right in your wheelhouse, I imagine.
Well, it is. First of all, I want to defend Vermont's
Efficiency Vermont.
Efficiency Vermont. They've really done a good job, and it's the envy of a lot of my colleagues down here, because as you remember, when Vermont was doing really well, we were actually reducing our use of energy. We were load growth negative, even as demand was picking up. And that was a result of efforts that the energy efficiency utility made. And by the way, what I'm impressed about with Vermont is that our big utilities like Green Mountain Power are full-time partners with Efficiency Vermont. They see that if they can, the cheapest energy to produce is the energy that you save. So the complaint that caller had, or that letter had, is more about whether there's some legislative path that imposes building standards, which is always controversial. But I think that the efficiency approach that Efficiency Vermont has taken has been very, very helpful. In fact, as I travel around and talk to a lot of businesses where Efficiency Vermont has come in, they're very positive about the contributions they've made. Now, down here in Washington, this is the one area where I'm able to make some progress with many of my colleagues who are categorically in conflict with me about climate change. You know, I am, like most Vermonters, someone who thinks that is an urgent problem that requires an aggressive response. But a lot of the folks I work with down here don't believe it. They deny the science. But on the other hand, when I talk to them about energy efficiency, whether they support coal or nuclear or wind or solar, less is more, and they see the benefit of saving money, and they know that efficiency does create jobs. They've got a lot of folks in their communities who are trade workers and want to do the retrofits in commercial and residential buildings. And, of course, it also has the effect of reducing carbon emissions. So we're making some progress on that, and we just had a bill signing with President Obama on something that was sponsored by me and David McKinley, who's a coal state Republican from West Virginia, and my partners in the Senate were Gene Shaheen and Rob Portman. So we made progress there in the beginning, and I serve on the Energy and Commerce Committee, and our Republican chair, Fred Upton, is terrific on this. I mean, he's really given me a lot of running room, and I've got a lot of partners there. So I think that this first bill that we got signed is a good indication that we can make more progress on energy efficiency.
Yeah, and that bill that was just signed by President Obama included legislation that encouraged energy efficiency in federal buildings, removed some barriers for commercial buildings. But you're now pushing for even deeper rules surrounding efficiency that include incorporating efficiency into the process for getting a federally backed home mortgage. Why do you want to see that happen?
Well, to some extent, it's what the writer was talking about. The more you can integrate good building standards, good practices, you're going to save. If you build a good, solid building that uses good materials and is tight, then that is going to have a long-term benefit by reducing energy demand. There's other things that we can do. You know, we can have renewable energy and energy efficiency resource standards for electric and natural gas utilities. We're working on having energy-saving performance contracts where our federal building folks can contract with a company that will put the upfront money into retrofitting a building and then get repaid with their profit from the savings that are accrued with lower energy bills. We've got a streamlining Energy Efficiency for Schools Act that encourages school-based energy efficiency upgrades. So there's a lot of practical things that we can do. And what I find exciting about this is all this is done at the local level, and every time a school or a federal building or a home is implementing energy efficiency standards, it's local folks who get those jobs. I mean, my wife and I had retrofitting done in our house. And I'll tell you, this is hard work, but these folks came in, and what a job they did, you know, retrofitting in our attic and all those drafty places. But that's local work that keeps money in the economy. So there's a lot of upside to doing this. I'm getting some partners on the Republican side, and it's the one promising area in this whole energy debate where we're making progress.
None of the efficiency mandates and suggestions that I've seen you to be encouraging for this legislative session really include transportation efficiency. In Vermont, that's certainly our biggest and most challenging source of fossil fuel usage and emissions. Now, there have been federal rules surrounding CAFE standards and increasing fuel economy on passenger cars and light trucks, and the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration projects that in model year 2021, on average, the combined fleet-wide fuel economy for a company will be 40.3 to 41 miles per gallon. But that just still gets us to where, you know, many nations, including many European nations, are today on fuel economy. So do you see more federal action needed in that arena, whether it's, you know, in the area of hybrid technology, fuel economy standards, or more incentives to improve public transportation?
Well, the answer to that is absolutely yes. And you've identified in Vermont our biggest challenge. The CAFE standards that were in executive order by President Obama obviously are enormously helpful because that's going to almost double the mileage per gallon, and that's going to save a lot of folks money as well as cut down on carbon emissions. But I've got legislation in to promote tax credits for electric vehicles. You know, the technology on electric vehicles is really improving. We don't have the infrastructure we need in order to have that as a good option. And the technology is getting better, so people will be able to drive longer distances. And with most technology, the more you can implement that, the more the price of those vehicles might come down in order to make it affordable as a choice for Vermonters. So that's an area where I think there's real potential for progress. And my contribution in that is this effort to extend tax credits for folks that are buying electric vehicles.
Again, we're talking today to Congressman Peter Welch, and if you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Rebecca is calling in from Hartford. Hi, Rebecca. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Great. I'm good.
I'm calling. Oh, good. First off, thank you so much for your service, Representative Welch. I wanted to ask you, recently in Vermont, we passed in our house the Healthy Workplaces Bill, or the bill that gives all Vermonters a standard of earned paid time or paid sick time off. And President Obama highlighted it in his State of the Union, paid time off, as an important issue. Is this something that you plan on working on or you are working on as a standard for the federal government?
Well, I support it. I do. It's going to be tough in this Congress to get that passed, so I'm not making any promises. But you're identifying what is a big challenge. You know, there's a lot of folks who would like to be in the workforce but aren't there, and in part it's because we don't have the kind of flexibility for workers that they have in many other countries where you get some sick leave. You know, families have people who get sick. Family leave. You know, families have children, or they have parents who are ill and need the care and attention of that person. So those sort of basic needs that all of us have in the workplace, I'd like to see us expand those significantly. So thank you for your work and your leadership on that.
But no movement that you see. You're not sponsoring legislation on that at the moment.
There's no movement here. It's not a doable thing in this Congress. I mean, I'm ready to sign on to legislation to do that, but I want to be clear in direct that that's just not in the cards with this current Congress. I mean, there's an enormous – this is really actually the heart of the fight between Republicans and Democrats to some extent. There's an unwillingness to invest. We're having ongoing budget fights here. And bottom line, there's a significant element of the Congress that believes that the best budget is almost no budget. Cut, cut, cut. We should be making prudent investments. I mean, it's appalling that we don't have a long-term transportation program. We've got potholes. We've got bridges falling apart. That's in every district of the country. And we're about to vote on a two-month extension, two-month funding for our transportation bill. So that's like, how can you build a bridge in 2 months? But it's the same with respect to cutting back on aid to education, to paid family leave, which really should be federal leadership because you can't put all this on the back of local taxpayers or even our small businesses. That's real tough in Vermont. But these are things where you're investing in the future of the country. You're understanding that you don't get something for nothing, and you have to invest in your infrastructure, and you have to invest in your human resources. And if I have a frustration in Congress, it's that there's not even a serious discussion about what should be our priorities. There's a big element in Congress who basically thinks that the way to prosperity is to cut, whether it's transportation, whether it's education funding, whether it's the National Institute of Health. I mean, I think it's appalling that we're not significantly increasing our commitment to basic scientific research. It's been those investments in the past that have allowed us to have technological breakthroughs that have created jobs and wealth and allowed us to have a middle class, which is now imperiled.
Let's go in a different direction. Dennis has a question. He says, are you supporting Bernie Sanders for president?
I'm not endorsing anyone, but I'm excited Bernie's running. And here, frankly, here's what I think. We've got two good candidates, and there may be more. I mean, Hillary Clinton, of course, is the bane of all the Republicans who are running. And I don't know how many are running now, 15 or 20, but their whole campaign platform is beating her up. And at a certain point, they're going to have to say what they stand for. But Hillary Clinton clearly has an enormous amount of experience and ability and is in a very strong position. Bernie represents a yearning, I think, in the American people to start talking about the bad things that have happened on Wall Street and to try to fix them, to try to stand up and give everyday Americans a shot at prosperity.
Has he asked you for your endorsement?
I haven't talked to him specifically about that, but I'm excited about Bernie's campaign. He and I have worked together really well, but you know what? This is a very exciting thing that's happening in Bernie's life. He made a major decision. It's exciting for Vermonters. The last presidential candidate we had who really had a big impact on the political debate, of course, was Howard Dean. And Bernie's going to have and already is having an impact on the debate. And I think all of us at this early stage in the campaign are going to be very excited to watch and see how this develops, both with the campaign of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and others who get in.
Representative Welch, I've got two topics that I still want to ask you about, and we've only got 2 minutes, so I'm going to let you choose. Do you want to talk about data security breaches and how to protect regular people, or do you want to talk about your trip to Israel and how that clarified things for you on Iran and nuclear security?
Well, Israel.
Okay. All right. Israel. Let's do it. So you took a trip to Israel. You've said it clarified your thoughts on Iran. You've supported the president's work on forging a deal with Iran to accept restrictions on its nuclear program. Israel's been very critical of those negotiations. So how did this trip clarify things?
Well, it had the trip focus was much more about Israel in the West Bank or Palestine. But the Israelis are against that nuclear deal. But they're against the nuclear Iran, and I strongly support the president because his goal of a non-nuclear Iran is totally consistent with what is important for Israel and important for other countries in the region. The real question is whether you can have a verifiable agreement that results in achieving the goal of a non-nuclear Iran as an alternative to military action. And when Mr. Netanyahu came here to speak to Congress, basically, the thing that he didn't describe after he vilified the president's program was what was Plan B.
Mm.
But what was encouraging in Israel, in the West Bank, is that, and this is different than Gaza, where you've got Hamas, but in the West Bank, the Palestinians have recognized Israel. They have renounced violence. They're willing to demilitarize. And they're Sunni Muslims who have no interest whatsoever in getting involved with radical Islam. So I left with some sense of hope that there's at least a basis where there may be able, on the ground level, between business folks and civil society, to start making some progress on a resolution between Israel and the West Bank, at least.
So you see a couple things there. You see resolution between Israel and the West Bank, you also were looking sort of more broadly at how Israel's needs and desires could fit in with this plan that the president has been moving forward with.
Well, that's true. And that's going to take some reassurance because the prime minister made it clear that they're nervous about Iran, and rightly so. We all are. I mean, Iran is not an ally at all. It's not somebody that you're going to enter into an agreement with that depends on trust. And the president's been very, very clear about that. But the goal that Israel has, that our allies in Europe, even Russia, have, is a non-nuclear Iran. And the question is, will these details that now are being negotiated with respect to verification of an inspection regime and the ability to snap back sanctions, will be able to dot the I's and cross the T's so that we can come to a verifiable and secure conclusion that we're thwarting the threat of a nuclear Iran?
That's Congressman Peter Welch. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up, NPR's Nina Totenberg joins us. She's set to give the commencement address at UVM this weekend. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This weekend, the University of Vermont will confer bachelor's and advanced degrees on nearly 3,000 students. They and their loved ones will be treated to a commencement address by Nina Totenberg, a highly regarded journalist who's well known to public radio listeners as NPR's legal affairs correspondent. Even if courts and the law aren't your natural passion, you've probably found yourself enjoying Totenberg's reenactments of Supreme Court justices making the lawyers before them squirm. Nina Totenberg, what a pleasure to have you joining us. Thank you.
And it's a pleasure to be with you.
You have a personal connection to UVM. Why does Vermont hold such a special place for you?
Well, my husband went to the University of Vermont Medical School, and then he was a resident at the University Hospital in Burlington. And you may not know this. In fact, many Vermonters may not know this, but Vermont Medical School was the medical school also for Massachusetts residents. When he went there in the 1970s, there was no medical school for Massachusetts residents, state school. And so Vermont was the state school that he went to. And he so fell in love with his mentor, the chairman of surgery, John Davis, that he decided to stay and do his residency there as well.
Ah, I didn't know that about Massachusetts. That's interesting. And I understand you also have a friendship with Senator Patrick Leahy.
Well, yes, I've known and covered Senator Leahy for God knows how long. And then it turned out that he had a relationship with my husband, because when my husband was a resident, I think it was when he was a resident, not a med student, I'm not sure, he and a couple of his friends wanted to start a place where kids on bad trips, drug trips, could go and get treatment. And the only way to know how to treat them well was to know what kind of drugs they had taken. And so he went to see then State's Attorney Leahy to ask him to help him do this. And so Pat Leahy, who then had a full head of hair, granted them immunity and told them that when they got some of these bad drugs, and there was a lot of bad stuff coming into the state at the time, when they got any of these drugs, they should take it over to the state police station. And so my husband, David Rines, who then had shoulder-length hair and a Fu Manchu mustache and bell-bottoms, found himself with a brown paper bag full of illegal drugs, walking into the state trooper's place with a sergeant with a buzz cut sitting way up high over him. And my husband's about 6'4", and he said he found himself saying, State's Attorney Leahy said I would. And the sergeant said, oh, yeah, we were expecting you. Come on back.
So it's a special relationship that they've had.
A very special relationship.
Nina, Vermonters have been particularly interested over the last several years in watching what the Supreme Court does around a couple of issues that have been central to laws here and to culture in Vermont. Certainly interested in looking at what the Supreme Court decides about campaign finance issues and how they play out, and then the debate over same-sex marriage and what's happening in the court this year. What do you look at in terms of how the court is thinking about those two issues as it's currently made up?
Well, you know, it's a pretty conservative court, and we know what five members of the court think about campaign finance regulations for the most part, in certainly limits on spending, independent spending, and that sort of thing. They've completely eviscerated, and the court believes very strongly that the five-justice majority believes very strongly that money is speech, and the four in the minority believe that money is not speech. And there you have it. And until the composition of the court changes or a constitutional amendment is enacted, I'm afraid that's where we are.
And on same-sex marriage?
Well, again, the court looks like it's divided 5-4, and I don't actually think we're going to know for sure how this is going to turn out until the end of June when it decides the same-sex marriage cases that are pending before it right now. And there are two questions. One is whether there's a constitutional right to marry. And the second question is whether states that allow gay marriage and whether the couples who are married in those states, whether those marriages have to be recognized in states where it's illegal. Now, obviously, if the court says there's a constitutional right to marry and no state can deny that constitutional right to marry, the second question is sort of moot. But it could split the difference, and in which case people who were married in Vermont could go to Texas and have their marriages recognized there if the Supreme Court said that Texas would have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an unlikely result, but I wouldn't rule it out.
I mentioned at the beginning that there's a real love for the way you talk about how what the justices have said and what the lawyers have said, and it's very sort of old school drama. But when you think about why you're conveying that information to the listening public, why should we care?
Well, you know, it really does govern our lives. If you're gay and you want to get married, for example, how this case turns out will affect your life very significantly. There's a big test of Obamacare again this year. The law could be eviscerated or not. A great many of the issues before the court do, in the end, affect how people live, whether they have access, for example, to contraceptive services and things like that, whether they have access to the courts, how criminal cases proceed, and increasingly what the rights of people on Facebook and in other social media are. And so, you know, all of these issues have an enormous effect on how people live, but there's no real reason for them to have known that unless they're directly involved. And so it's my job to make it interesting.
Well, your reporting on courts and the law is interesting, and it's integral to how a lot of public radio listeners know you and think of you. But where did your career in journalism start?
Well, I started out working on the women's page at the Boston Record, the Record American. So I worked for them for a while. I did an extra shift a great many times to work at night to cover the city council meetings or school committee meetings or the crime beat or whatever. And then I went to work for the Peabody Times in Peabody, Massachusetts, and worked there for about a year. And then came a presidential campaign in 1968 to New Hampshire. And I would go up after I finished work in Peabody, and I would go up and stay overnight and cover whatever was going on up there and freelance that material. And after that ended, I came to Washington and got a job with a small publication called Roll Call, which is a lot bigger now, and then moved on to a weekly general interest newspaper called the National Observer, which was published by Dow Jones, and then finally landed at NPR.
And that was in 75, right, at NPR, more than 35 years ago?
Yes.
Wow. Wow. So you will be giving the commencement address at UVM this weekend. As I mentioned, in the audience will be our own production assistant, Devin Karambalis, who wants to build a career in media. What advice will you be giving to grads on Sunday?
I actually don't give advice to grads that is terribly significant because there's nothing I can tell them that they haven't heard a million times over. My function as a commencement speaker is to not talk too long, to be at least mildly entertaining, to say something about what I think is important in citizenship is what I'm going to talk about, because this is, after all, this is the graduation for everyone, not just journalism students, not just medical students. This is the graduation for everyone. This is the big graduation. And lastly, I try to tell them something about life and what's important in life in the last analysis. And then you're done. You're out of there. And if you're lucky, they'll remember you were the speaker. But it's highly unlikely they'll remember what you said.
NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg is giving the commencement address at the University of Vermont this weekend. Thank you very much for your time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that does it for today. Tomorrow, Speaker of the House Shap Smith. As lawmakers steam towards adjournment, he'll take your calls and questions. Write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and tune in at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.